trying to fill in that time, but I sent you a little note about
I have it right here.
Thematic issues. I had a couple of others that I've just been thinking about, and was talking to some of the people about other matters, but they sort of reflected back on this. This is not a very carefully structured. But I think I've seen this before, but any biographical inquiry, you have the tension between looking at your subject as in terms of his uniqueness, and the other in terms of how he's an example of the genre. And I guess those always play one versus the other. And but I think it's an interesting question to ask about almost any stage. I think we all live out some kind of a script. We change it from time to time. We look back and discover it didn't always work out the way we thought, or we were working to a different script that we thought, but, you know, what was the script? And that's the life model kind of issue. And I think we've already mentioned trying to focus on what were major decision points, which is sort of another way of looking at the last previous question. And quite apart from my personal history, there's the evolution of the science in which I was embedded, and how was that moving? What was the perceptual framework? Not necessarily focusing too narrowly what my own contributions were. There was a lot else very interesting going on. I was both an observer and a participant. The take-home message is an issue of philosophy. Of, you know, what is it that in describing a life you're trying to communicate to others, besides some matter of ego presentation or portraiture? And I guess as much as anybody, I've lived a life of in and about science, and have tried to apply that mentality in a wide variety of other contexts as well. So one you know, might ask, that's part of the life model in a sense, but how do the particular things that you are doing or describing at any moment bear on that issue? Then there are a bunch of other sets of circumstances. These sort of go together, and they have to do with how to relate to others. And the scientific biography is primarily in your work life, and what was the laboratory environment, who you were dealing with. I've talked a lot about my mentors. I might want to say a little bit more about those for whom I played that role in turn. Then there are the various gatekeepers, the gates and the gatekeepers that you encountered at various places, and how they structure your interest and your opportunity, the issues of publication, granting, getting positions, and so forth. There's another kind of bottom line here, but the take-home message there is to the world, and this is the take-home message. What about people in your own needed arena, what can you draw from your own life that would be of some use to them? The next is a philosophy of science, philosophy of discovery, a much more abstract question than some of the others. And there are issues of styles of scientific work, and the question of risk-taking is, that's not the only one, but it's one that's dominated the kinds of polymorphous perverse enterprises that I've been. Then this is one aspect of a longitudinal inquiry, but there is an evolution of role in that, starting as an undergraduate and as a graduate student, totally immersed personally doing experiments, that more and more you're at first and second and third remove, and I guess I've gone the whole way in going full-time into administration and then back again. But it's not a sharp demarcation, and I think a lot of people don't understand the extent to which working scientists and don't spend a very large part of their time actually at the bench, people ask me, am I now back in the laboratory? And my honest remark has to be, well, no less than any of my other colleagues as professors at the university, but I have a little bit of a twinge that it's not a completely honest statement saying I'm in the lab. I'm in here talking to you. I do visit my lab from time to time, but I spend most of my time interacting with what's going on actually right here, and of course relating to literature as well, equally importantly. But there is an evolutionary and developmental aspect of that, the detail of that working role as a scientist. Well, I don't know what other things like that you've
long experience. Actually outlined it very well, and I think that's an extension of what you included to me earlier. Those are exactly the kind of things that I keep looking at when I'm talking to people. We've touched on a little bit of that. We're now reaching a point where I think we want to explore some of those issues in more depth. I think it might be easier to do it chronologically.
Well, episodically, at any rate. It just occurred to me as we were both speaking at once that the point of leaving New Haven is an episode in which you just go through these themes and say, is there anything more you want to bring out from that interval before we leave it that might reflect on each of those issues. I suspect they one way or another have been covered, but I think it's not a bad heuristic to do that at different stages. So I agree with the chronological framing of it. So what did you have in mind to go on with right
well,
now?
Well, I had some pre-Wisconsin questions I wanted to back up.
Let's make sure we cover all that.
And look at.
Okay.
As I said, unfortunately, for some reason, my notes did not, at least I can't find them where they should be. So I'm going to have to rely on my less than successful memory. One more time.
And it was in the context of an alternative to my going back to medical school, which would have mooted the issue of a PhD, that he thought I would have more flexibility, which was, of course, true. And so we arranged for de facto retroactive registration. And the big stumbling point was paying the fees, which I had to cough up. Wasn't easy, but we managed to do that, and the paper that I was drafting for publication was accepted, in fact, as the dissertation plus another 20 or 30 pages of general commentary. Well, that has become much more routine. In those days, the dissertation used to be thought of as being a completely independent manuscript. I think Yale was just then transitioning to the idea of accepting other published work as legitimate dissertation material.
Was there any... well, Tatum obviously was doing all of this for you. Was there mm-hmm. any objection, do you think, on anybody's part?
I don't think so, no. It, you know, the work stood for itself.
Right.
I think
exactly.
It was recognized there quite promptly that it really was pretty important. And it had Tatum's imprimatur, so...
I noticed in your publication list that you list your PhD thesis as being some 45 pages or something like that.
There is some additional commentary that mostly on some of the mathematical aspects of calculating linkage maps and so on, but there's really nothing substantial that hasn't been published as the other papers.
Now, you didn't say anything about that summer at Woods Hole. And basically, you were finishing writing up when you were down there. That was the summer of 47. 47.
Yes. Entirely. Using the library, and that's where I dug a little deeper into the background history of variation in bacteria. I think I read everything that anybody's ever written on the subject. They had an excellent library, 24-hour access, direct to the stacks, and so forth. I may have given you a reprint of that. I've revived some of the material that I dug up at that time for this ASM News.
Right, and I wanted to pursue that because you have a very eloquent statement in there in talking about today's students who are allergic to the dust in the library stacks, as
mm-hmm.
you put it. And that the recent journals are all they need. I was struck by that comment. I've run into that same experience. But I'm wondering whether in your career, whether that attitude has that changed? Is it more current now than it was when you started?
Well, the distaste of students for antiquarian inquiry is a more recent phenomenon. I don't know how deep-seated it was at the time. There was an inclination to not bother much about historical stuff from as far back as I can remember on the part of other scientists, but I had broader interdisciplinary interests anyhow than most people did, so this fed into that strain. But I can't really scold our youngsters today. They've got more than they can handle in trying to keep up with current literature. It's next to impossible to do that. So it becomes an ever more obviously losing battle. But there is stuff there that can be quite informative and quite stimulating. I mentioned a couple of specific examples that were very clear. Now, I don't know how much of that would still be pertinent. This is at a time of opening up not an undiscovered continent, but one the existing inhabitants of microbiology barely had a few new biochemical tools. That was a rising discipline. But the role of genetic analysis was even more closely coupled with issues of natural history. There is an affinity between history and natural history,
mm-hmm.
in part because people could make useful naturalistic observations with quite primitive tools, and so that literature goes back 200-300 years, and I'm sure there are still things that have been recorded a long, long time ago that are going to be revived from time to time. But whether it's the most cost-effective thing to do, it It rather depends. If you're looking for major problem areas, it may be just as useful as the current literature. If you're trying to solve an existing problematic challenge, then it's probably true. You can't sample at all, and if you do nothing but this last year's annual reviews and the current literature, it's not perfect, but it's probably as good a use of your time as anything. And you may have reason to feel badly if you find you've already been anticipated, but it's hard to know what better heuristic to offer. So I wasn't suggesting in my news article, ASM news article, that students abandon everything they're doing now, but just to have a little bit of sensitivity and respect for that kind of inquiry. And since not many other people are doing it, I thought I would bring back, exhume a number of old issues that are still sitting there. And so I'm hoping that somebody will pick up some of the themes I've mentioned.
In that regard, it used to be very common to have a history of chemistry course in a chemistry department mm-hmm. for a major. Did biologists do the same thing?
No. There's very little history of biology offered. There are maybe four or five chairs in the country that are doing this, and hardly at all for biologists. So there's a little bit of a specialty interest in it, but the general answer is no. Now, a little bit of history is incorporated, but if you take a textbook of any of the biological disciplines, you'll find some historical information. The better books have more of it, in my opinion. And we're beginning to see more reflection. I mean, we've been through such a phase of extraordinary dynamism in experimental biology in the century. A number of people are starting to take stock, and I have the fun of being able to do this within my own lifetime. That the stuff I used to hear about, used to think about, is now history. But, so there's a series on developmental biology, for example. Gilbert has been editing, got some wonderful essays and reflections on it, and so on. There's beginning to be a school of history of recent biology, and of course some of the stuff down in Philadelphia is an important element of that as well.
And there is, if I'm correct, there is no discipline center for history of biology as there is for physics and chemistry. Is that true?
No, nothing. We're writing ragtail on your chemistry project for a good piece of it. Biology is such a diversified set of activities, it would be more difficult to do without how to centralize it. But, and we don't have the societal organization, which is, again, a reflection of the same matter, to be that kind of a focus.
You think that those people so inclined have more of an interest in the history of medicine and that aspect of biology than they would?
Well, the history of medicine is a more settled discipline. Mm-hmm. Than biology, and a lot of physicians have turned to history, certainly in larger numbers and proportion than biology.
You commented that the McCarty paper of 1944, which was a landmark paper, changed your life. It was a major...
Well, it changed all of our lives. But it did in a very personal and gripping way.
And I wanted to explore that a little bit. That's sort of in keeping with what we were talking about here. First of all, did you see that paper as a matter of course in your reading, or were you aware of the results before the paper appeared?
We heard a little bit of it beforehand. I can't give the precise dates, but Mirsky was a frequent traveler between Rockefeller and Columbia. He was collaborating with Arthur Hollister. And so I'm sure we heard in various seminars what was going on with nucleic acids. Mirsky had his own interest in nucleoprotein. There was undoubtedly a certain amount of envy relationship between him and Avery. That's been overplayed in later commentary. While he and Avery were in some dispute at a legislative stage, Marcy, in fact, was the principal communicator of what was happening. So I'm sorry, I can't give more precise dates on that point, but and I was going in and out. I was intermittently on campus. I was being shuttled back and forth between the Naval Hospital, where I was working as a corpsman while I was in the B-12 program, and back to school. But I know that there's talk about it. We didn't get the journal in Morningside Heights, but I knew that Harriet Taylor, later a Frissy, had a copy. She probably gave a journal club on it, be my guess, and she had some close connections. She later went to work with Avery a year or two after that, but at that time she was a graduate student. And so I asked to borrow her copy of it, and that's when I first actually read the detail, and I have recorded what I'd actually written in my diary about it. If you've seen the text quoted in one of my articles, I have a very gripping recollection of it.
So the response to that was I won't say instantaneous, but pretty
close.
Oh, it
was. Well, there was some prelude to it, but it was a fairly general talk, and then read the paper and was able to see in some detail the nature of the experiments, and that told me this was solid gold. And while I didn't have to believe everything about it, and the paradox is that because I thought it was so important, I tried to keep an open mind about the details, probably longer than most, and I would still be sympathetic to Mirsky's arguments that it has not yet really been proven that that was DNA alone and not DNA plus protein. I was content enough to believe either one or the other, but I thought something as important as that really ought to be nailed down very solidly before you take it as a matter of faith and go on from there. And other people either ignored it or bought it, and in a certain sense didn't think any more deeply about it. And so I just wanted to explain that paradox.
That whole somewhat lengthy argument about protein and DNA, did the people who supported the protein argument finally give in? Was it a long drawn out affair?
It was long drawn out. And I guess giving in was more by exhaustion than by any single event. I'm writing a piece right now about the Watson-Crick paper in 1944, which coincided with the interval of let's not make any more fuss about it. It is DNA. And in some measure, that was because the Watson-Crick model very beautifully correlated with the pure DNA model. It wasn't that there was any more experimental evidence on that point, but it did fit things together. There are people who will argue that the issue had to do with whether DNA was capable of having the informational diversity needed for genetic activity, and that was certainly in there. But as soon as one kept an open mind about the Levine tetranucleotide model of DNA structure and could imagine any irregularity in base sequence in the DNA, and you could do that without going all the way to the double helix, then the possibility of informational content was there. And that was already tacit in Avery's first discussion of the matter. So I would say it was rather a question of cleaning it up, both figuratively and literally, to just be sure that protein wasn't sneaking in and playing some role in the source of specificity. Now, curiously enough, although Hershey is often credited in the Hershey-Chase experiment in 1952 with having given the final experimental evidence that it was DNA alone that was sufficient in this case to maintain the genetic propagation of the bacteriophage. You may remember he did a double labeling experiment where he labeled the DNA with P32 and the protein with sulfur, and found that after infection he could find the phosphorus in the infected bacteria but not not the sulfur. I've had arguments with people, and I finally found the source that corroborated my recollection of the matter. In the 1953 Cold Spring Harvest, excuse me, 44. The Watson Crick paper, of course, is 53, 44 is Avery. In the 1953 Cold Spring Harvest Symposium, the same meeting where there was an early announcement by Watson and Crick of the DNA structure in the discussion of the paper, Hershey still expresses some reservations and saying that if you would ask him right now, he still thinks it's nucleoprotein. And his experiment leans in the other direction, but he knew better than anybody that it was not that conclusive. You could still have had several percent contamination of the nucleic acid and would not have seen it. What it did show was that most of the protein is shed, and most of the DNA gets into the cell. So he was, even at that stage, still reluctant to buy the pure DNA story. But that was the last peep that I ever heard in a serious scientific vein. There were a couple of people. There was a paper by Barry Commoner, and there was one by Carl Lindegren, still protesting. Mm. This is during 1953. That no, it hasn't been proven that life is DNA. There was no serious protest after that time. The Watson-Crick model crystallized, figuratively, again as well as literally, a way to picture DNA structure that would be compatible with the rest of the construct.
Was Commoner attacking on scientific grounds?
Yes. It's hard to say. Barry is quite an ideologue. He's the same guy who's stopped us from incinerating anything. I don't know if you've heard his name around the country.
Yes.
I don't know why he dipped into that. He had done a little bit of work with plant viruses, but he was not really a geneticist or DNA biochemist, but he just thought it was too simplistic. Anyhow, there were still some rumblings about this, or some lack of realization that this really had to be taken seriously as the chemical basis of genetics, and that it was no longer just an interesting hypothesis, but had to be regarded as the foundation of any further work in the field. And as I may have mentioned to you before, I felt strongly enough about that that when the time came for me to compose my Nobel Prize lecture, I did something quite unorthodox. I only referred incidentally to my own work and instead wrote a commentary on the field. It's called A View of Genetics, and it was a manifesto that says DNA is the view of genetics. And I referred to my work within that framework. I thought it would have been folly to do otherwise. I mean, just to talk about my own experiment, which had been done in a way that was inspired by DNA models, but did not make direct use of them, much to my frustration, I would have very much liked to do, and then ignored this important revolution that was still going on. I didn't think that would make much sense.